This is Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Your feedback helps us know what we're doing right and what we need to work on. Make sure to send us ideas for guests and programs, too. Today, I talked with Senator Rand Paul, the Libertarian Republican who was overwhelmingly reelected to a second term by the voters of Kentucky. I talked with Paul about why he's completely against giving former UN Ambassador John Bolton any position in Donald Trump's State Department, and why he will vote against any budget that doesn't show spending and revenues balancing at some point in the future. We also talked about whether his easy 14-point election win in his home state signals that America, or at least Kentucky, is getting more libertarian. Without further ado, here's Senator Rand Paul.
Hey, Nick.
Hi, Senator. Good to hear from you. Thanks for taking the time today. You are an automatic no on John Bolton getting, I think in your words, anywhere near the State Department. And you said he hasn't learned the lessons of Iraq. What do you base that on? And what for you is the essential lesson or lessons of Iraq?
Well, I think the lesson of the Iraq war was that regime change doesn't make America safer, didn't make the region more stable, and didn't really advance any vital American interest. And I think this has been true of a lot of interventions, not just the Iraq war, but also the regime change in Libya, I think led to chaos, the rise of ISIS in Libya. And really, we wound up with something worse than what we had. And it seems to be a recurring pattern in the Middle East. The reason why it's still an important question is, you know, we have Assad in Syria, once again, not a Jeffersonian Democrat, but at the same time, people should ask the question, if your goal is to topple Assad, what next? What comes next? But Bolton, I would say, is an unrepentant advocate, not only of the Iraq war, within the last few months, actually within the last few days, he said he's not backing down from that at all. And so that means he just really hasn't learned any of the lessons. He was a chief advocate. He was a big promoter of the fact that Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, which turned out not to be true. And I think that he's learned none of the lessons of the last several decades in the Middle East. And it's important because, you know, 6,000, well, probably a little over 4,000 died in Iraq. Mm-hmm. But we've had 6,000 soldiers die in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think it's an important question to ask before we make toppling Iran's government our policy, which is what Bolton promotes. Before we make that our policy, we need to understand what that will mean and the lives that will be lost for something that in the end you may wind up with something worse than what you started with.
How is your line of thought or your conception and framework of foreign policy? Is it getting more of a hearing among your fellow Republicans as well as Democrats? Because, I mean, you, a couple of years ago, you were, and I would like to talk about Syria very briefly, you were the most outspoken person leading the charge against a kind of reckless American intervention into Syria. And that was widely seen as actually hurting your chances both to be reelected as senator, but also in the presidential primary season. Are more Republicans starting to come your way in terms of regime change or in terms of this fantasy that America can topple governments and replace them with something better? And it really isn't a very difficult or prolonged process.
You know, I think it's a mixed bag. You know, you look at Donald Trump won the presidency unequivocally saying that the Iraq war was a big fat mistake, were mm-hmm. his exact words, saying that regime change was not a good policy, saying that it's hard to rebuild our country here or to have nation building at home if you're having nation building abroad. These are all things that I could have said, in fact, might mm-hmm. have said at one point in time. So in that sense, you have someone who's been elected president of the United States that really has at least evoked at least a grasp, a portion of what the libertarian foreign policy would be. And I think that's exciting. On the downside of it, it's not always that consistent of a message. And the fact that the administration would consider Bolton makes one wonder how deeply felt or deeply held those beliefs are, or if they're just various voices vying for different, you know, different aspects of policy.
Do you?
But, that's why I push very hard to say that I want Trump to pick someone who agrees with what he said on the stump and that John Bolton's not that person.
Now, Rex Tillerson is, you know, as Secretary of State, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that he's a businessman primarily. And do you like the idea of necessarily delinking the State Department from kind of military intervention? And I know that you've said you're going to give him a fair hearing. You know, is it a good idea to have a businessman or somebody who's used to trading and negotiating with somebody at state rather than somebody from a military background?
I think anytime you can have someone be part of the administration that's not already part of the furniture of Washington, it's a good idea because I think it tends to shake things up. I think you want someone who's accomplished, you know, someone who can manage a large organization like the State Department. I think there are some parallels between negotiating a business agreement and negotiating with adversaries in the sense that in order for a business negotiation to be completed, both parties have to actually believe they won. It's one of the anomalies of an economic transaction is that it's not said to be equal. It's actually said for both parties to believe that they actually won the transaction. I think diplomacy is somewhat like that as well in the sense that, and maybe even more difficult because in diplomacy often there's a winner and a loser in a war and you have to negotiate a peace. In order to negotiate a peace with the vanquished, you have to somehow allow them to save face and allow them to feel that it's to their advantage to sign something, you know, that may represent the loss of a war. But even when it's equal footing, like on trade, there still has to be the belief that you're, you know, trading with equals and that you're willing to negotiate. So I think there's a lot that can be said for someone who believes in the idea of negotiation. I think what's left unsaid yet for me is just, you know, what's his worldview? Does he advocate for regime change? Mm-hmm. Does he advocate for more diplomacy and less war? So there are a lot of things that will come, but I'm not automatically against his nomination. We'll just have to see.
Right, in a way that you would be for Bolton. And for you, regime change is really the kind of controlling idea that you're pushing back against at the State Department then.
Yeah, and another word for it is intervention. Mm-hmm. But I mean, intervention is typically for regime change. And I think it's there's a naive worldview that believes that, you know, if we topple Gaddafi, the Libyans will elect Thomas Jefferson. And this is really the neocons are probably the most naive group in foreign policy that we've ever witnessed. But we've let them turn it around and try to attack non-interventionists as being the naive ones. And I think without question, it's utopian and naive to believe that there's sort of absolute good out there and absolute evil. And if we get rid of the evil, somehow good will replace it. And there's also just no historical evidence that it seems to work. We don't seem to get better governments when we topple them. We often have seemed to gotten worse.
You talked a bit about the lessons of Iraq. What are the lessons of Syria? Again, you know, you were the person who pushed back most strongly and effectively against Obama intervening several years ago. You know, what do we owe the people of Syria anything, given the way that we've mucked around in the Middle East and we've destabilized the region, which isn't to take away any responsibility for atrocities from the people committing them, but you know, what is the lesson for Americans and what is the responsibility, if any, for Americans for Syria today?
You know, I think that you can't look at the images from Aleppo and not be, disheartened, upset, you know, just the gut-wrenching pictures of what's going on, you know, the completely bombed out city and the just people leaving by the droves. It is very sad. You could argue that, we promised too much and didn't end up helping them. Mm-hmm. Or you could argue, you know, it's always the question, have we done too little or have we done too much? Some would argue now, oh, we're not doing enough to help them. But I would argue that we did too much in the beginning to promote the idea that we were going to be there, you know, side by side with them toppling Assad. And by promoting that, the war got bigger and went on longer and longer. In the vacuum, ISIS grew. But also, I don't think the war would have ever gone on this long had we not intervened on the side of the rebel forces. And it's not to say I don't have sympathy for those fighting against tyranny, but at the same time, I think what we're going to wind up with is, and we already have wound up with, is a humanitarian nightmare. But there is no easy answer now to it. Diplomacy could have some effect, and that diplomacy would be convincing Russia to stop bombing civilian populations and to convince Assad to stop bombing civilian populations. But in order to do that, you have to have some kind of conversation, and you have to have some kind of give and take as to convince them why. And at this point, it would be probably a negotiated peace settlement, because it doesn't appear that there's a great deal of fighting force left against the Assad regime.
Should we accept more refugees or help resettle people elsewhere, if not the United States?
You know, when you look at the Statue of Liberty and you see that it says, "Give me your poor, your huddled masses," I think at the time it was written, we were a very welcoming country, and many people came here from around the world, but they came here with a sponsor and with the understanding that they would work or they would be sent back home. In fact, Ellis Island wasn't always as welcoming as people think. You showed up, and if you were sick or infirm, they sent you back immediately. If you didn't have a proper sponsor and you weren't working, you were sent back either then or later. So I'm not against people coming to this country. I'm not against expanding the country. I'm not against any of that. But I am against sort of bringing people in through the refugee program and putting them in government housing and putting them on government insurance. I don't think that's a good way to teach about the greatness of our country, is by sort of socializing the experience of being a refugee. I also think there are some dangers. I mean, in my hometown in Bowling Green, had two Iraqi refugees plotting to buy Stinger missiles to attack us. So, you know, I think there are arguments for why we need to be very careful about who's coming in, and that they want to become part of America and not against America.
Let's talk about the budget deficit. If you've been outspoken on Bolton getting anywhere near the State Department, you've been equally outspoken about refusing to sign any budget or approve any budget or vote for any budget that doesn't balance sometime. We're looking at about a $587 billion deficit for the last fiscal year. That's only going to go up. When does the budget have to balance for you? To sign off on something.
I think the one thing I would just say that's off the table is a budget that never balances, and that's sort of what we're going to be confronted with January 3rd. It's a budget where spending goes up at about 5%, revenue goes up at about 4%, but it'll add, I don't know, $5, $6 trillion over 10 years. But the lines never cross. Mm-hmm. So really, it's not even of me demanding which year it has to balance, which I am concerned about that. But what they're offering is a budget that never balances.
And let's be clear, when you say what they're offering, you're not talking about Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama and Harry Reid.
This is the Senate GOP.
Yeah. What is it about the refusal to even, you know, fake the math that's going on in the Republican Party? This is the party of smaller government, of fiscal responsibility.
They're not even calling it a budget. They've retitled it the vehicle to repeal Obamacare. So we've been told we're not supposed to worry our pretty little heads about the numbers, and that the numbers don't matter in the budget. And my response has been, if the numbers don't matter, put good numbers in. And, you know, balance the budget. If you say it doesn't really matter and you're not going to adhere to it anyway, why don't you actually put forward something that Republicans across the country have actually voted for? The other thing is the balanced budget amendment that we have all voted for, the most recent one, Mike Lee put a lot of work into it, I put some work into it. It says that we must achieve balance in 5 years. So if we're actually for that and we'll vote to make that part of our Constitution, why wouldn't we, when we have the chance to put a budget forward, actually put one forward that is consistent with the balanced budget amendment? But I can tell you the whole debate over Obamacare, the many years long debate, has gotten people where they just don't care. Many conservative groups in town who would be up in arms if this were a budget the Democrats were putting forward have sort of acquiesced, because they think, we're just going to use this as a vehicle to repeal Obamacare. And as much as I dislike Obamacare, and as much as I'll vote to repeal it, if I were to compare the significance of the $20 trillion debt, $1 million every minute, if I were to consider and compare the significance of that versus Obamacare, I have to probably come down saying that debt is a bigger problem. So anyway, I'm going to be a no vote. If three of us were no votes, We could force the Senate GOP to put forward a budget that actually balances in a reasonable point of time. But there are no other declared no votes at this point.
Talk about what's the ratio of cutting spending to either keeping taxes level or increasing them or decreasing them? Because I guess the reason why nobody ever cuts spending is because that's going to cause some immediate pain to some kind of constituency. What needs to be cut or restrained in a significant way in order to keep, to bring the balance, the budget to some kind of balance, especially in 5 years?
What I would say is that there are various ways you can balance the budget. If you look at the current revenue coming in and you say, well, we're just going to freeze all spending, the budget actually balances within 5 years with a freeze. Mm-hmm. If you talk about like a 1% cut, like I've advocated in the past, the penny plan, 1% across the board, you'd actually balance in 3 or 4 years. So it really, to my mind, doesn't take that much to actually do it. But realize that you have to freeze the entire budget, not just the military, not just the non-military, but all of the entitlements as well. And since you're adding new people to the entitlements, it does become a job of trying to figure out how to do this. Rather than do it across the board, I would be fine. If all we could get would be across the board cuts, I'd be fine with that, or across the board freeze. But to make it easier on yourself, why don't you completely eliminate some things you don't need? So if you're trying to struggle next year to balance the budget, why don't we cut $30 billion in foreign aid that nobody in America would ever know this was gone, and do that for a couple years? Why don't we cut out a lot of the crazy grants that we give to people studying, whether selfies make you feel better, things like that. So there's all kinds of stuff that we could cut, and I'd eliminate some entire departments rather than cut everybody across the board 1%. It would make your job a lot easier. But bottom line is there's not a healthy appetite up here among Republicans or Democrats for any kind of spending cuts.
Can I just one very quick final question? You won easily re-election in Kentucky for senator. First off, how did that make you feel? And do you think, was that at all a kind of referendum on your brand of libertarian republicanism? And do you see that as a positive sign, or was it disconnected from what you actually did in your first term?
Well, we had a big victory. We were 14 points, and I traveled the state extensively. We ran as if it were, a tied race the whole time to make sure everybody knew what we'd been doing. And I think it has to, in some ways, be a referendum on what you stand for and what you vote for, because we do try to let everybody in Kentucky know about it. And I think Kentucky in general has become more aware of the burden of regulations, particularly with our coal industry, but also with our farming community as well. And so I think there is definitely us becoming a more Republican state is basically much of that based on worry about regulations causing the loss of jobs.
Great. Well, thank you
so
much.
Well, I got to run.
You bet. Appreciate
it. Thanks. Bye.
I'm Nick Gillespie, and this has been the Reason Podcast. Never miss an episode by subscribing now at iTunes. And while you're there, rate and review us and let us know how we're doing. Thanks.